Massive sheets of ice cover four-fifths of Greenland, an area about a third the size of the United States. If those glaciers were to melt completely, it could raise sea level by over 20 feet. Now, that's not expected to happen anytime soon, but Greenland's glaciers have been melting more and more quickly in recent years. Here to talk with me about why that's the case and what it means for future sea level rise is Dr. Fiamma Stranio. She's an assistant scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Welcome, Fiamma.
Hi.
And if you want to join our conversation this morning, if you have questions for Fiamma or comments, give us a call at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can email us at thepoint@wgbh.org. So Fiamma, glacial melting is probably the biggest wild card, the least understood part of trying to predict future sea level rise. It was such a source of uncertainty that, in fact, an international panel of scientists in 2007, when they were reviewing what we know about climate science, decided to basically leave glacial melting out of their sea level rise predictions. Why is there so much uncertainty about how fast the glaciers are melting?
Right. Well, picture that an ice sheet is essentially a big, big mass of ice sitting on land. That's Greenland and Antarctica. It's very similar. And there are two ways in which this big ice sheet can essentially lose mass, shrink. One of them is just if you increase air temperatures right above it, you're going to melt some of this ice and form meltwater that essentially, like rivers, is going to flow right into the ocean. And that part we sort of understand. If we have good predictions of air temperature, then we can predict increases or decreases in surface melt. There's another part to ice sheets, though, that is much, much harder to understand, and this is they're in sort of perpetual motion. You pile up snow, and it turns into ice in the center on the sides, and the ice moves. And so the other mechanism in which ice sheets, these big masses of ice, lose ice, is essentially they break off big pieces of ice, icebergs, and dump them into the ocean. And what's happening here is ice is sliding. Imagine like a river of ice flowing on land, and eventually it comes to the ocean. These pieces break off. This second part, it's called a sort of dynamic ice, the dynamic ice discharge. This dynamic part is much, much harder to predict. And this is the part where people have a really hard time saying how it will change.
So as I understand it, as the ice sheets are sliding, there's water that's underneath the ice sheet, right, that's kind of lubricating the ice sliding over the land. And that's one of the sources of uncertainty is how that motion works, how that friction works, right?
That's right. So one of the things, the reason why the ice sheets, both Antarctica and Greenland, are getting so much attention is that about 20 years ago or 15 years ago, all of a sudden, ice started moving faster and they started losing more mass. And right now, Greenland and Antarctica are contributing to about half of the sea level rise that we're observing. The other half is essentially the ocean warming and expanding. But the ice sheets have changed quite dramatically over the last 20 years. And a really large fraction of this change is due to the fact that these glaciers are moving faster. And this kind of took scientists by surprise. We didn't really have models that could predict it. We haven't had satellite data for a very long time, but for the period when we've had satellite data and photographic reconstructions, this acceleration is sort of fast. And so since then, many scientists have been working to try and understand why are these glaciers moving faster. And because a lot of glaciers, let's talk about Greenland, a lot of glaciers started moving in West Greenland, Southeast Greenland. We think there's a common driver, and it has to be either the atmosphere or the ocean or both. If it were just a single glacier moving, you could say, well, it's that particular glacier. It's doing its own thing. But because this has been a sort of systematic increase, we think there's a common forcing. And so we've been trying to understand which one, and many hypotheses have been put forward. Remember, we don't really understand how ice slides very well. And one of them says, well, if we start melting at the surface of the ice sheet, this water makes it to the bedrock, the bottom, and it acts like a lubricant. It makes the ice flow faster. And so this hypothesis was proposed about 10 years ago, and it's one of the hypotheses. Right now, this one has been put a little bit on the back burner because we don't see the seasonal acceleration that you'd expect with this hypothesis. So you get more surface melting in the summer. And so if this hypothesis were true, you'd expect to see more sliding in the summer. But we don't see that. The glaciers don't change that much. And so now we're considering other hypotheses. Some of them have to do with these glaciers essentially terminate. They end in the ocean, and they end in the ocean in these long, narrow fjords. Imagine like a valley, like a U-shaped valley filled with water with a glacier coming in at one end. And there's a lot of ice bits where the glacier come in. Some are icebergs, some of it is sea ice just formed because it's cold around Greenland. And so some of the hypotheses now have to do with, well, maybe this sea ice, all this ice was acting as a buttress to glacier flow. And so if we warm air temperature or ocean waters, we can remove this plug and the glaciers can flow faster. But the dominant hypothesis is really the one that my colleagues and I and others have been working on, is what if these changes were driven by the warming or changes in circulation of ocean waters reaching these glaciers. And so when these glaciers come into these fjords, they are exposed to a large area of contact with the ocean. And there's a lot of melting that goes on. The ocean waters around Greenland, as we discovered, are relatively warm. And so...
So just, I want to start. Define relatively warm, because we're talking about a place right up near the Arctic. So.
That's right. Well, some of the warmest waters we've observed are about 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, which comes to about 40 Fahrenheit. And so that's not bathtub warm. You wouldn't really want to swim in it, but it's very warm for ice. And that melts ice, essentially. And these warm waters are coming all the way from the Gulf Stream, from the subtropics. And usually they're offshore of Greenland. They're on off the continental slope. But what we've been able to show is that actually they reach these fjords. They're found at depth. They fill the bottom of these fjords. And they reach the glaciers. And these are the principal waters driving melting. And so the idea that we're testing or trying to understand is, if you change something in the ocean circulation, if you warm these waters that are found offshore and they reach the glaciers, what happens? If you increase melting where the glacier comes in, you're sort of, again, you're modifying this kind of plug that's keeping the glacier from moving. If ocean changes can modify the shape of this glacier as it comes in, you can make the glacier slide faster. And so this is really trying to understand this dynamic effect. If we change the ocean or we change the melting at the ice edge, is this what has caused the glaciers to slide faster? And the reason why people don't want to put numbers to this effect is it's not this, these processes are not in the models right now, right? Models are a set of rules, equations that tell you this is how an ice sheet moves and melts, this is how the ocean works. But you have to put this physics, these dynamics in. And this part is the part we don't know well enough. It's not even in the models yet.
So does that mean that the predictions for what we should expect to see in terms of sea level rise have been rising pretty dramatically in recent years? I think the consensus is kind of forming around the idea that we're probably going to see about 3 feet or 1 meter of sea level rise by 2100. Does this new understanding about how oceans are melting the edges of glaciers make that number seem too low? Should we be expecting more than 3 feet in the next 100 years?
So a few years ago when this... intergovernmental, so international panel came out with this report, the projection of sea level rise for 2100 was essentially a foot. And as you said, they on purpose excluded the impact of ice sheet changes because we didn't really know how to put it in. So the number that you're citing now, which is about 3 feet by 2100, is starting to consider the fact that we are having all these ice sheet changes. In fact, if you look at sea level rise right now, which is about 3 millimeters a year, that's about a tenth of an inch a year, and you just say, let's assume it's constant from now till 2100, you're going to get about 3 feet. And the problem is that what we're seeing now from satellites is that this mass loss, so this loss of ice, when you take ice that's been sitting on land and you put it in the ocean, then sea level goes up. This is essentially the process we're talking about. It doesn't matter if you melt it while it's on land or you melt it once it's in the ocean, right? You put icebergs in and then they melt. It's still going to drive up sea level. And so this process has not been steady. It's been increasing. So now that we have very accurate satellites over the last 10 years or so, we can actually see that the rate of mass loss, it's not constant. It's going up. And so this indicates, if these trends continue, that, you know, we might be looking at even higher sea level rise by 2100. It's very hard to put numbers on, but we have to be aware that it's a possibility.
I want to remind everybody that you're listening to The Point on WCAI. We are talking with Dr. Fiamma Stranio about the melting glaciers in Greenland and what that means for sea level rise. If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 866-999-4626 or email us at thepoint@wgbh.org. So when you're talking about how these predictions about future sea level rise are made, it sounds like a lot of it is based on basically our observations of how much it has been rising, how quickly sea level has been rising, and projecting based on that. So if we have that empirical way of predicting sea level rise, why is it so important to understand sort of these behind-the-scene mechanisms, how not just that the glaciers are melting and how quickly, but why and how the melting is happening?
The empirical way is, right now, it's not really based on any physics. And to some extent, it's our last resort. If we don't really know how to predict the future, we're just going to extrapolate what's happening now, or we might look at the past. But in practice, if we can predict the changes in the ocean and in the atmosphere, this is really what we're trying to do with climate models. Once we should be able in time to predict changes in the ice sheets and understand essentially how they work. There are a lot of questions about changes that happened in the past and future predictions. So you know, we really need to understand these dynamics so we can learn how this system works. Because some of the changes that we might be seeing over the last 100 years might be unprecedented, meaning the rate at which they happened, the drivers, if we believe that there's a man-made driver of this, which still needs to be established, but this kind of forcing hasn't happened in the past. So this is why we really need models to understand the complexity of the system.
You mentioned earlier that there's a seasonality to the melting of the ice. And again, I think folks who haven't been to Greenland might not understand what seasons in Greenland or seasons in the Arctic mean, because even the summer is fairly cold. But most of the data that we have about the melting is based on summer research. Right. And you actually were one of the first teams that we know of to actually go and do a winter survey. What did you learn from being there during the winter?
Yeah. So Greenland is actually a really interesting place. Antarctica is very cold. It's sort of buffered by this big current that goes around Antarctica called the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. It sort of prevents warm water and warm air from reaching Antarctica. But Greenland, on the other hand, it's southern tips. It's at relatively low latitudes. And it actually has a strong seasonal cycle. I've been out in the summer in Greenland in t-shirts. In the winter, no, it's cold. But so, you know, there is such a thing as a summer. And what happens in summer in Greenland is that air temperatures are well above freezing, and they drive a lot of melting. And so you literally see these rivers of water coming off of the glaciers. And a lot of this water ends up in crevasses, in cracks, and then it comes out well beneath the surface in the fjords. And what we think it does, it just drives a really vigorous circulation at the bottom of the glaciers, and this, we think, contributes to melting. So in summer, we have one regime that's really influenced both by the ocean and by the summer runoff. In winter, on the other hand, the summer runoff is non-existent. The air is cold. There's no rivers of water flowing off the ice sheet. And so when you go and make the measurements in winter, you're actually seeing a different regime, one in which the only melting is really driven by the ocean, and the circulation that drives melting is due to the ocean. So we were very interested in comparing these two. Right now, everything we know is just based on summer, and we found that things were quite different. For one, these deep ocean waters are warmer in winter, about one degree warmer. And this has to do, it's counterintuitive. These are the things that are surprising, but it actually has to do with the fact that these waters are below the surface, so they don't care too much about the summer and winter in Greenland. They were at the surface further south, and so the waters that end up in the fjords in winter stored the maximum amount of heat because they essentially were at the surface in summer further downstream or further upstream and then ended up. So this is just something of the ocean circulation. But again, we had a clue that this was happening from some data collected by seals, essentially. Some biologist had tagged seals. They put a little radio and little sensors on, and the seals dive, and they spend a lot of time around Greenland, and then they send back data when they come up to the surface. So we had an idea that this was happening. But still, we went out to really try and understand and see this. And again, we're trying to build an understanding of these systems. The summer surveys don't reflect the year-round conditions. So that's why we went to collect wintertime data, so we could have a better idea of what happens throughout the year.
John is calling us from Orleans. Good morning, John.
Your guest has commented that sea level rise could be tremendous, in excess of 3 feet. A study group comprised of representatives from eight Arctic Rim countries have announced in a conference in Copenhagen in early May that a rise of 5 feet may well happen by 2100 or even sooner. Could you comment on that specific study group finding? Thank you.
Yeah, as we were talking earlier, because we don't have a really good way of predicting what's going to happen to the ice sheets. What scientists are doing, they're using a number of tools. Some are statistical, some are correlations. You sort of extrapolate. And so there are a range of possibilities. And some people are saying up to 6 feet, 7 feet by 2100. Some people are saying are being more conservative for. And, you know, there are a number of studies that come up with numbers. And when we don't know any better, what the only thing we can do is essentially say, well, it's probably going to be somewhere in the average of these numbers. It will take a while for climate models to be able to make these predictions more accurately. So for now, we can only base it on present time observations and these more empirical or statistical methods.
But so I think up until this point, a lot of the predictions have kind of been phrased as we might see up to 3 feet, that might be the maximum. And you're saying now, actually, we should be looking at this as at least 3 feet.
I think so. If anything, because of this trend that we've been seeing in the mass loss from the ice sheets. And again, it's very difficult to make predictions without a tool like a climate model that really includes all of the physics. But based on what we know now, I think 3 feet is a lower bound. And the report that came out with 3 feet admitted that the ice sheet's contribution was underestimated because they essentially didn't know how to do it.
Studying these glaciers is not easy to do. I've seen pictures of you hanging out of a helicopter and using small boats, dodging through icebergs. Tell us some of some of the craziest stories, some of your favorite stories from actually going up to Greenland and collecting this data.
Yeah, I mean, these places are beautiful, I should say, and so sometimes you just stop and you're out there for a minute and you look around and you think, I'm so lucky because I'm working in one of the most spectacular places on the planet. So the glaciers are huge. They're several miles across. They're about half a mile deep when they come into the ocean, and the icebergs that break off in these relatively small fjords are sometimes a mile long. They're big, and so we try and make measurements in a number of ways. To some extent, we've used every single thing we can get our hands on. It's hard to get research vessels, big research vessels, inside these fjords because there's a lot of ice. You really need an icebreaker. The depths are uncharted. Captains of research vessels are not really crazy about going where they don't know what the bottom's going to be. And so we've been going in with a lot of local boats. These are tiny boats that the Greenlanders use to fish and hunt, which is still how they provide for probably about half of the food that they consume. And they're very skilled at navigating around these big blocks of ice. Some of the boats we've used have been, pretty small, 30 feet and so on. And we really rely on local knowledge, wisdom of these places. And so we navigate in these fjords, we make measurements. We also leave instruments that we anchor to the bottom to collect year-round measurements. But then no matter how big the boat, at some point there's, well before you get to where the glacier touches the ocean, there's so much ice that you just can't go in by boat. Nobody can go in. The ice pack is too dense, and it's not sea ice that you can break with an icebreaker. These are humongous pieces of iceberg. So that's where we use helicopters. We essentially fly over this stretch of maybe 15 miles, which is all covered in this rubble field, and we look for patches of open water. This ice is mobile, so you cannot land with a helicopter. And so then you open the doors, or if you've flown without doors, which we sometimes do because it speeds things up, you essentially find these patches and then you release a probe. This is an instrument that will measure temperature, salinity, sometimes velocity. And you have to ask the helicopter pilot to hover above this patch while you're retrieving the data. And then you sort of just cut the line with scissors and you ask him to go to the next patch. So this is it. You know, it's the only way we have to get these measurements right now. And I think in the future we'll try and develop better ways. But we've been able to collect some really amazing data, including in that winter survey when most of the fjord was inaccessible. But with the helicopter, you can do things. So it's also fun, and you have to be creative. You have to adapt. Usually I make a lot of plans before I leave of what I'm going to do. And then usually by the time I get there, you just essentially throw all of them away because something always happens that just makes them worthless. And you have to redesign your field plan on the spot. You have to always make the most of what you can realistically do.
At one point, you worked off of a Greenpeace icebreaker. And I know some of your colleagues were a little hesitant to kind of mix, or not necessarily actually mix, but, you know, be working off of a boat that is owned by an advocacy group when they're trying to do objective research. So tell me about that experience.
Greenpeace, essentially, they were interested in raising public awareness on Arctic change, and they offered logistics support for scientists to go work on board. And for us, it was an amazing opportunity to get a platform. It was an icebreaker with a helicopter that we could work off. And while I was on the ship, there were a lot of journalists, because that's essentially how Greenpeace works. They sort of attract attention. The journalists were interviewing us. And I remember at some point there was a French journalist who said, "Well, I'm writing this blog, but a lot of people are saying you can't be an independent scientist because you're on a advocacy ship." And I said, "Well, you know, the ship is the platform." And my answer was, you know, if an oil company or anybody offered me, called me to offer me a platform to go work off like Greenpeace did, I would go with them too. It's really, the research we're doing is funding limited. It's very expensive to get out there. We know very little. We're really seizing every opportunity we can. And so I've worked with Greenpeace, but I've also worked with miners. I've worked with local Greenlanders, and none of them have interfered with the science, and all of them have been really instrumental in getting the measurements.
We've just got a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask you what you've got on tap coming up. Are you headed back to Greenland this summer, next winter?
Yeah, I'm headed back to Greenland this summer, and in fact, it will very likely be on the Greenpeace ship again. And we're still making measurements in some of the glaciers that, as I said, about 15 years ago, just sort of picked up and started accelerating. But what we're also doing is we're going to try and get some measurements from some glaciers far, far north that haven't been changing and that haven't changed yet or are not going to change. And it's very important because we don't have these measurements from these glaciers in the south. We don't have measurements from the time before they accelerated. And so we're trying to build this knowledge for other glaciers in Greenland just in case they change. At least we know what they looked like before. So that's what's happening this summer.
Well, Fiamma, it's been great to have you here, and thank you so much for sharing your information and your insights about Greenland. You've been listening to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thank you all so much for listening.